Good morning, everyone. Peggy, I am so glad that you're here this morning, and thank you for reading. And I thank everyone else who is participating and supporting the service. Greg is behind the scenes. Sally's behind the scenes. Jorge is coordinating things. We heard from Jim. Emily's going to read later on. Mike, thank you for being a part of us today. I thank everybody. And I thank everyone for attending also. So I'm calling this the miracle of justice. I start with an observation, an admonishment, and a challenge. And the challenge is that we reach beyond our cloistered class and walls, be larger and braver, and take the initiative and act for justice. Not many of us are Christians, and few of us know the Bible very well. I am not, and I do not, but I read the Bible closely. I am certain I would not find the term social change. Social change is a safe term, a 20th century middle class construction. In the Bible, Micah calls to let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. In our movement, Theodore Parker, one of our best ministers ever, has words made famous by Martin Luther King Jr. The moral arc of the universe is long, but I believe it bends toward justice. So today, I am speaking of the miracle of justice in ways that we human pulled it toward us. Justice is not a given, and like every birth, it is hard, and like life itself, it is an ongoing process of becoming. We heard from Holly Near this morning. There's a song in our hymnal. Sally, what is it? It has the line, "We are a justice-seeking people." We are a justice-seeking people. Oh, it's singing for our lives. And one refrain is, "We are a justice-seeking people, and we are singing for our lives." Near wrote that after San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk was assassinated in 1978. Seeking justice is a journey. Arriving at justice is a dream. It is not a destination to reach. It is a goal to work toward. So I have good news and bad news. The good news is that we are in a moment where more people are both open to and seeking justice. The bad news is that gains in justice are not certain, and that many who are against justice are absolutely committed to the status quo. They will kill to get their way. They always have, and they always will. So how do we advance these times? By what miracles do moments of justice get created? I will start with reflections from my journey. If you want peace, work for justice. I heard and learned that from nuns involved in the nuclear freeze movement in Toledo, Ohio in the early 1980s. I was in my late 20s and had given up on the Democratic Party electoral politics after years of election campaigns. Peace is gained through justice. That starts with the personal peace reached when one sees clearly, has a clear understanding of oneself, and the arrays of power and control in the human-built world around her. We need an analysis built on the values of our lives. We need a framework of ethics and, spiritual beings that we are, theology. Our Unitarian Universalist principles offer such a grounding. We have seven of them, and we're most familiar with the first and the last. The first is believing in the inherent worth and dignity of all creatures. Last is the interdependent web of life in which we are a part. The second principle is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. The sixth also champions justice, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And the fifth is very American, transcendentalist, really. the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregation and society at large. As principles, these are the foundations of our theology today, our little movement of almost 200,000 souls, including some 40,000 children. Maybe it's a miracle that we are still here, as small as we are. But here's the biggest miracle of all, that the United States is not a slave nation. If I was speaking to you 161 years ago in 1859, let's say we lived in the center of the country, population-wise, that would have been Cincinnati. In August 1859, most people thought slavery was implacable. It would be with us forever. That decade started with the Compromise of 1850, created when Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act, requiring slaves caught in the North to be returned to their owners. The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 allowed each of those territory citizens to vote to come into the Union as either slave or free states. And then the Supreme Court ruled in the Dred Scott case in 1857 that slaves and their descendants were not U.S. citizens. Slaves were ruled by state law and not covered by the Constitution. In 1858, Abraham Lincoln said in the speech, "I believe there is no right and ought to be no inclination in the people of the free states to enter into the slave states and interfere with the question of slavery at all." In 1860, the Republican platform advocated not extending slavery into free states or the territories, but that was the extent of how they addressed slavery. So, if we were in Cincinnati in August 1859, our Universalist congregation might have been abolitionists, but we were no more powerful then than we are now. Our just cause was not going anywhere. In 1859, 4 million people were enslaved and the country was stuck. Neither a solution nor compromise to slavery was in the political cards. Yet, 20 months later, South Carolina cannons were bombing Fort Sumter. That was April 1861. South Carolina had led five other southern states out of the Union. 11 states would form the Confederate States of America. Why did that day come? It came because in October 1859, out of nowhere, well, actually out of what they called Bleeding Kansas, John Brown and a band of 21 men attacked a U.S. Army arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, now West Virginia. No one else wanted to start a slave rebellion, but John Brown did. My high school English teacher, Harold Feltner, said John Brown was a fanatic. "Jesus too," he said. Both men went knowingly to their deaths. Mr. Feltner said to my class back in 1972, "Rational people don't volunteer to die." But maybe, and this is me, not him, maybe rational people don't create miracles. So, October 1859. 6 years later, in April 1865, the Civil War was over, and almost 4 million enslaved people were free. That is a transformation that can only be described as a miracle. How did it come about? My message to you on miracles: people are forced into them. They are not planned. The South ruled by fear instead of embracing hope. They panicked at the prospect of Lincoln becoming president. He was inaugurated in March 1861 to lead an already divided country. The South was frightened to death that Lincoln would end what? End slavery? He would not have. He did not hold that position or political belief in 1860 or 1861. He was forced into the miracle of being Abraham Lincoln. The South forced the miracle of freedom, of justice for 4 million enslaved blacks into the reality of American society. In 1861, it was a time when no one thought that day would ever come, certainly not in their lifetime. One determined fanatic, John Brown, and his commitment to freeing the slaves by taking over the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry changed everything. Well, that and Southern fantasies about reality. There was a doppelganger miracle. South Carolina seceding from the Union in December, 1 month after Lincoln was elected, December 1860, South Carolina withdrew from the Union. That's the astonishing fact that created the Civil War. The South volunteered to leave the Union. From the cauldron of crisis, miracles might bubble up. The miracle of being, naming, and performing as our true self or true selves. Southern leaders reacted to Lincoln's November election by proving they were racist and undemocratic, more committed to owning people than living in a democratic society. I'm going to repeat that. Southern leaders proved they were racist and undemocratic. A system of slavery, a slave nation, is by definition not democratic. Slaveholders had no interest in negotiating an end to the system. Not only was their way of life going to be taken away from them, they loved their way of life. So they left the Congress and they withdrew from the Union. And that is a miracle in its own way. It is a miracle when we know and act our true selves. People who act for justice must plan and deal with people who are committed to inequality and justice. We live in a country today where perhaps 20 to 40% of the population stands against equal rights for all. This has become very visible these last 4 years, and as Peggy tells us, every single day. I am helped by my simple definition of evil. Evil occurs when people do bad things on purpose. Evil is in actions. It is a verb and not a noun. It's not a person and it's not a thing. We want miracles to produce good results. That is part of the definition of miracles. But the ingredients that form the conditions of a miracle are both good and bad. Or, as my ex-wife used to say, to use a very simple example, you have to kiss a lot of toads before you find the frog who becomes your prince. Neither the frog nor the prince is in every frog, in every pond, or every kiss. It is a blessing to have the miracle of recognizing others that are acting on their own true selves for what they are. We need to believe what we see and hear and not rationalize or excuse evil actions under the veneer of our being polite or holding civilization together. That is not helping. John Brown helped. He acted against evil actions. He meant to start a slave rebellion. Let me give you a bit of his biography just briefly. Brown was born into a religious anti-slavery family. This environment, ethic, and theology followed him from his birth in 1800 in Connecticut to Ohio in 1805, then to Pennsylvania, back to Ohio, and eventually to Kansas, where he moved in 1855 to fight pro-slavery forces as the territory battled to become a free state. Brown's anti-slavery views grew stronger as he aged from seeing a black boy beaten with a shovel, which made him, quote, a most determined foe of slavery from then on, unquote. At 19, he hit a runaway slave in his cabin. And then when he moved to Pennsylvania, he built a barn that had a secret room for runaway slaves. He knew his true self, and he was committed to living that life. Famously, Brown responded to the 1837 murder of Elijah Lovejoy, an anti-slavery newspaper editor. Brown, and this is a quote, stood up, raised his right hand, and vowed that there before God in this church, in the presence of these witnesses, he would consecrate his life to the destruction of slavery. And he did. In 1849, Brown moved to the free black farming community of North Elba, New York, and he lived there for about 6 years. In 1855, Brown moved with his sons to Kansas Territory. In response to the sacking of Lawrence Canvas, Brown led a small band of men to Pottawatomie Creek in May of 1856, and that's where he performs the infant, or his band hacks five pro-slavery people to death. Frederick Douglass had a relationship with Brown, and he reported that Brown told him in 1847, he was organizing a slave uprising in the Allegheny Mountains. And some sources say he was planning that for as many as 20 years. Brown had years of financial backing from Boston and New England abolitionists, including Franklin Sanborn, a good friend of Henry Thoreau's. Brown planned and fundraised in the region, and he spoke with Thoreau more than once. In 1859, Brown made his way to the area near Harper's Ferry with a band of some 20 men, both black and white. They planned and trained for months to free slaves, raid the federal arsenal, and then capture arms to pass out as the start of a slave uprising. The October 16 attack did not succeed. As Neil Gunderson wrote, Brown was an incompetent general and tactician. This is a history and a bit of the intense anti-slavery life of John Brown. 2 weeks after Brown was captured, Henry Thoreau rented the Concord Meeting Hall and gave the talk, a plea for Captain John Brown. He was all in on Brown. He called him, and these are quotes, a man of rare common sense and directness of speech, of action, of transcendentalist, a transcendentalist above all, a man of ideas and principle. This is what distinguished him, not yielding to a whim or transient impulse, but carrying out the purpose of a life, of his life. And then Thoreau said, he did not value his bodily life in comparison with ideal things. He did not recognize unjust human laws, but resisted them as he was bid. For once we are lifted out of the trivialness and dust of politics into the region of truth and manhood. No man in America has ever stood up so persistently and effectively for the dignity of human nature, knowing himself for a man and the equal of any and all governments. Now, most of us probably well know that in 1848, Thoreau had been arrested for refusing to pay a tax, his protests against the war against Mexico and against slavery. He wrote the essay we know as Civil Disobedience. Thoreau's thinking was always consistent. In 1848, he said, and this was also a lecture he gave, a very few as heretics, patriots, martyrs, reformers in the great sense, and men served the state with their consciences also, and so necessarily resisted for the most part, and they are commonly treated as enemies by it. So Brown did what Thoreau did. Thoreau wanted, and this is in Civil Disobedience, he wrote, action from principle, the perception and the performance of right changes things and relations. It is essentially revolutionary and does not consist wholly with anything which was. It not only divided states and churches, it divides family. I, It divides the individual, separating the diabolical in him from the divine. And he said in Civil Disobedience, unjust laws exist. Should we be content to obey them, or should we endeavor to amend them and obey them until we have succeeded, or should we transgress? Shall we progress them at once? Men generally under such government this think that they ought to wait until they have persuaded the majority to alter them. They think that if they would resist the remedy, that would be worse than the evil. But it is the fault of the government itself that the remedy is worse than the evil. It makes it worse. Why is it not more apt to anticipate and provide for reform? Why does it, the government, not cherish its wise minority? This is thinking of people who know themselves, who have analyzed and understood the world around them and act for justice out of principle. They act not knowing the outcome of their actions. They act in the time and at the place they live, responding to the reality of their society. Their actions are a surprise and a gift in the case of John Brown and Henry Thoreau, miracles. Blacks have been Brown's advocates for the past 160 years. In his 1909 assessment of Brown, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, John Brown worked not simply for black men, he worked with them, and he was a companion of their daily life, knew their faults and virtues, and felt, as few white Americans have felt, the bitter tragedy of their lot. In 1964, Lenore Bennett Jr., an editor at Ebony Magazine, wrote, and this is 105 years after Brown was hung, "It is to John Brown we must go finally if we want to understand the limits and possibilities of our situation. He was pure passion, pure transcendence. He was an elemental force like wind, rain, and fire." Well, that was a surprising passage. And immediately, I only read this week, and I was going to do the "There is no struggle, there is no progress" since I planned to do the service today. So Frederick Douglass, back in 1857, his speech insisting, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its mighty waters." That is such an important analysis. I had it read at my wedding. Struggle is a necessary part of life. Maybe the progress that bends the arc toward justice always requires human forces of nature, be it civil disobedience or violent confrontation. People insisted Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, a dozen other cities this spring and summer. Others asked, why are they rioting? Why are they getting arrested? Why aren't they protesting peacefully? As we work to create the miracle of an anti-racist future, we need to learn and act on the understanding, and this is a quote from Ibram Kendi, the principal producers and defenders of racist ideas will not join us. And that's from his book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racial Ideas in America. There will be no miracle transformation of lions laying down with sheep. Those embracing racial discrimination find blacks unequal, Kendi wrote, and will not be changed by facts or logic. Racist ideas and racist disparities are defeated by ending racial discrimination through policies that treat blacks and people of color equally. So the miracle of advancing justice is realized in not giving up while being clear that the opposition will not change. A miracle is when the masses in the middle change and accept change. And hopefully we'll help make that happen.